Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. If you are a reader or have a loved one who is, it's time to get ready. This hour, we'll get recommendations for some of the best new books for giving and receiving this holiday season from some of Iowa's independent booksellers. We talked about children's books last week, and you can find that list on our website at iowapublicradio.org. Today, books for grown-ups. With me, Jan Weissmiller from Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. Hello, Jan.
Hello.
Tim Buck, also of Prairie Lights in Iowa City. Hello, Tim.
Good morning.
And Hunter Gillum of Beaverdale Books in Des Moines. Hello, Hunter.
Hello.
Thank you for being here. And we're going to start with fiction this hour. And I know you've all made your picks. You've all had to pare down your lists. I'm sure it started much, much bigger. But Tim, I'm going to let you give us your first fiction pick first.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm happy to get started. My first pick for fiction is a book called Tin Man by Sarah Winman. And it is simply the best book I've read all year. It is a small little novel, only 213 pages, but boy, it packs a wallop. And it's set in England, in Oxford, in the late 80s, and our main character is a man named Ellis, who is having a bit of a midlife crisis. He's approaching 40, been working the same job for years. We know a few things about his life, but not much. But as we follow through the novel, he thinks back on his life, remembering the best moments and the worst moments. And he's a man who's had a lot of grief in his life, and he's trying to learn how to come to terms with it and move on. It's not a sad novel, although it is a little bit of a tearjerker every now and then. But it is really more about carving out peace of mind when you have a little simple life that doesn't, no big events, but friendships, marriages, deaths, that sort of thing. He's trying to learn how to move on and accept who he is without succumbing to so much of the grief that has been a part of his life. But it's a really beautiful little manifesto about just finding the beauty in life and moving on. And it's incredibly powerful. You can read it in one sitting, and if you cry openly, just embrace it. It's just the way it's going to be.
It sounds like the perfect antidote to our society at this point, for those of us in the middle of our lives.
It might be. You'd be surprised what little things can mean so much to you, really, and the beauty of friendship through your life.
All right. Tin Man by Sarah Winman. And you're next, Jan.
Well, I have my favorite book, as everybody who works with me knows, and it is Deborah Eisenberg's new collection of stories, Your Duck is My Duck. And Deborah Eisenberg is a highly, you know, she's a wonderful short story writer. And she writes slowly. This is her first collection in 12 years. Her last one was Twilight of the Superheroes. And there are six stories in this book. They're all great. And the title comes from the first story, which is about a woman who is a painter in New York. She's not making a living, and she sort of runs into somebody at a party. Although, when she's talking about the party, she said, "Parties. Why was I going to all these parties? No one meets anyone in person anymore." But she does meet this couple who have, as she says, a serious quantity of money. And they sort of take her under their wing, and they invite her to South America, where they have this place where she can paint. They're sort of high-end criminals. I mean, and the title comes from one of them talking to some minion, and he says to this minion, "Do you know the Zen cone about the duck in the bottle?"
I don't.
And it is the Zen master's response to how do you get the duck out of the bottle. "It's not my duck. It's not my bottle. It's not my problem."
All right. So this sounds very funny.
It is. She's very funny, but she's also serious. I mean, this is a serious story, too, you know, about the 1% and the not 1%, and about the environment, actually, because of things that are happening in South America. But all together, it's very, very funny. And there's a long story about that takes place in a restaurant in New York where I think six or seven octogenarian actors have come together for lunch because they're angry about a biography that's been written about them. And it's just also just great.
All right. And I'm getting to be a bigger and bigger fan of short stories. And maybe that's just lack of time. But you can sit down, read a story, and have a complete experience when maybe you don't have time to read a novel.
And also, I think a lot of times people have thought that short stories end sort of up in the air sometimes or often. And we're living that way now, so we respond to that better.
All right. We've been trained by reality. All right. That is Your Duck is My Duck by Deborah Eisenberg. It's a short story collection, the first pick on Jan's list. And that brings us to you, Hunter.
All right. So first off, I had The Overstory by Richard Powers. And in this book, the sort of trees play a central role, and it opens, well, in the overstory is the very top part of a tree, and then other sections in the book are like roots and trunk and things like that. But then it opens, and it sort of details each character's, I think there's like six different characters, and it details each of their connections to trees. And then eventually they would all kind of come together in the protesting of the clear cutting of old growth forests in the Pacific Northwest. And it just is just a wonderful way of talking about like, their, you know, people's connection to nature. And he deals with like the passage of time in a very, very interesting way. And it's just beautifully written. And I really, really like this one.
All right. Overstory by Richard Powers. The Overstory by Richard Powers. And next, we're back to you, Tim.
The next book on my list is a book called They're There by Tommy Orange. And your
Which
listeners.
Both you and Hunter picked.
Okay,
yeah.
Well,
that was
I'm
my
glad
next
to
one.
Hear that, Hunter. maybe we can share some comments on it.
Yeah.
It was a very big book when it first appeared on the scene earlier this year and was on this long list for the National Book Award. It is a very gritty, realistic look at Native Americans living in and around Northern California, around Oakland. And the first part of the book is really a series of profiles as we meet these individuals who are somehow maybe connected 6 degrees of separation a little bit. And they're all converging on a Native American powwow that's going to be held at Oakland Coliseum. So it's as we start to meet those people, we start to learn some connections, some relationships, and then they're all converging on this one point. I will say the last 60 pages of the book are absolutely unforgettable. And I have had some people in the store say they couldn't finish it, they couldn't put it down, or they couldn't get through it because it is rather a bleak book. I mean, these people are marginal characters who have histories of abuse or drug use, but don't give up on it. It is sort of the literary equivalent to watching a Martin Scorsese film from the 70s. So if you could handle the grit and the realism, there is a huge payoff in the end, and it's definitely worth it. It's an important book, and I think people are going to be studying it in writing classes for years to come.
Well, and Hunter, this is a debut novel, so, I mean, that makes it even more surprising.
Oh, yeah. And especially with the structure of the novel, to have this be your first book, I think, is just incredible. And to have such an ambitious book be your first book is just astonishing.
And
yeah.
Hunter, the way he jigsaws these puzzle pieces together at the end is just pretty phenomenal.
And you can kind of just slowly see it happening, where different characters will like come in contact. But then in the end, yeah, the way he puts it all together is amazing.
Sounds like a mind-blowing moment there.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
It is pretty a big eruption of all the things you've been reading for the previous 100 and some pages just come to fore.
Well, I am intrigued. They're There by Tommy Orange, chosen by both Tim and Hunter, a double recommendation, so even more powerful. All right, Jan, it's your turn next.
Well, I'm going to talk about Rose Ellen Brown's new novel, The Lake on Fire, which is sort of a Gilded Age story set in Chicago. It's, I don't know, she's written a number of novels, and she's really good at merging the personal and the historical, I would say. She has another fantastic novel called Civil Wars about a couple that met in the civil rights era, you know, in Mississippi, and came from very different backgrounds, and that's a great book too. But this book is it features this. It starts in Wisconsin, where a Russian Jewish family has a Russian Jewish socialist family has, you know, relocated, and of course they really know nothing about farming. And they're relatively miserable, especially their young, beautiful daughter. And so she runs away with, and her younger brother, with whom she's very close. I mean, they share this sensibility that's almost mysterious. I mean, that, you know, the way that they perceive each other's thoughts.
Bond.
Yes,
okay.
Yeah. And so he follows her to the train station, even though he's only 12, and gets on the train with her, and they go to Chicago. And right away, she meets this wealthy man named Gregory, handsome, sort of a cross between Jane Austen and Dickens, I think. You know, I mean, it's sort of a Mr. Darcy thing, but it's more like there's kind of like this sort of he's always questionable in
darkness,
a certain way.
Okay,
yeah. But she, they meet immediately, but she gets a job in a cigar factory, and Asher starts pickpocketing and working the streets like a Dickensian character. But then she very, very quickly gets involved with Gregory and gets into a whole nother world, and which includes Jane Addams, though. She meets Jane Addams, and but she and Asher meet, and he is really seeing the underbelly. So she's got the view of the Gilded Age view, and he's got the view of the really dark, you know, poverty-stricken world, and also of the people that are building the Chicago Exposition, the Columbian Exposition, and they're living in poverty, and they're building these things for these incredibly wealthy people. It's just a very, very rich, complicated novel.
The juxtaposition of the haves and
right.
have-nots.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah.
Is it a long read?
It's not, you know, I mean, it's not 500 pages or anything. I think it's more like 350. It's kind of
right.
normal, but yeah.
It sounds like it could take you deep. All right, The Lake on Fire by Rosalind Brown. Rosalind Brown, thank you. And that is Jan Weissmuller's second fiction pick for today. We'll continue with fiction picks from Jan, from Tim Budd, both of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. Hunter Gillum is also here with us, Beaverdale Books in Des Moines. And we'll get into the nonfiction picks a little bit later this hour. And don't worry if you've missed a title, we'll also be posting this on our website later today, iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's our annual holiday book show. We're finding out about the best new books for giving and receiving this holiday season from some of Iowa's independent booksellers. Jan Weissmuller and Tim Budd of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City are here, and Hunter Gillum from Beaverdale Books in Des Moines. And Hunter, since you and Tim shared a turn last time, I'll let you go now and tell us about your next fiction pick.
So my next one was Come West and See by Maxim Loskutov, and it's a collection of short stories, and it depicts a rural uprising that is happening in the West. So it sort of takes place in the near future, and the crazy thing about him is none of the stories are deal with somebody that is directly involved in the uprising. So it's kind of all people living with this uprising happening in the periphery, and how it affects their daily lives, and most of them are just kind of trying to just go about their, you know, normal routines and stuff, but then have, you know, government helicopters are flying over to go fight the militias that are, you know, in the West and stuff. Deals a lot with, you know, isolation and different things like that. But it was very astonishing. And then again, it's also a debut as well, but very good.
All right. Yeah. When you said a rural uprising happening in the West, my mind immediately went back in time, not forward in time. So does this have similarities to some of the protests that we've seen in recent years?
Kind of, yeah. You know, to me, it was like a more modern version of the kind of like the Ruby Ridges and stuff like that, where there'd be like a separatist movement in the West. Mm-hmm. But they also don't really, because it's none of the characters that are involved in it, or none of the stories have characters directly involved in it. You don't really know a lot about, how the uprising got started or why they're doing this. And so a lot of that kind of remains unseen, but it has a feel like that similar feel to it, you know.
And all of the short stories in the collection are connected?
Yes. Well, minus the very first one starts is the only one that takes place in the past, and it takes place in like the 1800s in the West. And it's also the weirdest story in the collection. But I think it sort of sets the stage and kind of paints a picture of this is the way the West has always been. But all of the other ones are connected, not with similar characters, but all in the similar geographical location and all dealing with like the same rural uprising.
Interesting. All right. Come West and See by Maxim Loskatov. And that brings us back to you, Tim, your next pick.
My next choice is a nod to historical fiction for you fans of this genre called The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock by Imogen, I hope I'm going to say her name right, Imogen Hermes Gower. This is her first novel. She has a background in archaeology and art history. It is a sprawling, adventure through 1785 London. George III is on the throne. He hasn't gone crazy yet, but we've lost the American colonies. The two main characters are the merchant, Jonah Hancock, who was a very mild-mannered, conservative man. And I don't think I'm spoiling anything because this happens in the first chapter. He's awaiting a ship to come back from the Caribbean. The captain arrives on his door, has traded the cargo and the ship for a mermaid. The mermaid has deceased, but they did catch one, and he encourages Mr. Hancock to put it on display for the general public, which he does, and the money he brings in sends Mr. Hancock into a social stratosphere that he is not used to. Our second main character is Angelica Neal, who is a very high-class courtesan, let's say that politely, who has been a kept woman and is now back in London and feels at 25 she has one more chance to find another man to keep her in the lifestyle she's accustomed to. So basically, these two characters do meet via the mermaid and her launching. And it is the most delightful, wonderful, character-driven. It's not Dickensian because we haven't gotten there yet. It's more like Henry Fielding, I guess, in Tom Jones. It's quite bawdy because we are dealing with, you know, prostitution a little bit here. But every character, from supporting to the main thing, is just a delight. And if I can just give you one taste of a sentence from this book, thus they sleep and thus they wake. There ought to be little else said on the matter, for lovers are all the same and only of interest to themselves. But on this count, it is remarkable. Angelica Neal has not felt this way before. Or if she has, she has forgot.
This sounds like an escape.
It is a definite escape. It's a big book. It's like almost 500 pages. So from those cold winter nights when you need something to keep you warm for a weekend or a week or two, I would definitely recommend it. It's a wonderful romp.
All right. The Mermaid and Mrs. Hancock. Imogen Hermes Gower is how we're going to say that.
Sure.
All right. Jan, you're up next.
Well, so I'm going to talk about Little by Edward Carey, and it's his second novel for adults, but he's also written a number of novels for kids, for young adults, and he's an artist. And so all these sort of gifts that he has come together in this book, because if you were looking at it, you could see that on almost every page. There's a little illustration.
Nice.
And it is it's an historical novel about Madame Tussaud. And I had also planned just to read to you from the beginning of it so you could get a sense, just the sense of the voice, and then I'll talk a little more about it. But and he does every chapter like a novel that would have been done in the 18th century. You know, chapter one, in which I am born and in which I describe my mother and my father. In the same year that five-year-old Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart wrote his minuet for harpsichord, in the precise year when the British captured Pondicherry in India from the French, in the exact year in which the melody for Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star was first published, in that very year, which is to say 1761, whilst in the city of Paris, people at their salons told tales of beasts and castles and men with blue beards and beauties that would would not wake, and cats in boots and slippers made of glass, and youngest children with tufts in their hair, and daughters wrapped in donkey skin. And whilst in London, people at their clubs discussed the coronation of King George III and Queen Charlotte, many miles away from all this activity, in a small village in Alsace, in the presence of a ruddy midwife, two village maids, and a terrified mother, was born a certain undersized baby. And, you know, and he just writes like that throughout the entire book.
And he spent a decade writing this?
Yes, 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 and did a huge amount of research. And I think, you know, she's very dear to his heart, obviously. But, you know, she never gets any taller than probably 4'10 or something, or maybe even shorter. She says she's the height of most people's hearts.
Oh, wow.
And she's orphaned very young. And, well, actually, her father dies first, and then she and her mother go to live with this wax. Her mother answers an ad to work for a doctor, and the doctor turns out to be a wax worker. And so when the mother dies, he trains her, and she ends up in Versailles.
Huh. All right. And now we can connect that with all of the tourist attractions with wax models all over the world. And all right. So Little by Edward Carey. And that brings us, we'll go back to you, Hunter.
All right. So I had Waiting for Tomorrow by Natacha Apana. And so this novel opens with a couple meeting in college in Paris. And then they would go on to get married and move back to the husband is from the countryside in France. And so they go back there. And the husband was sort of an aspiring artist, and the wife wanted to be a writer. And then they both make sacrifices for the family. And so the husband, I think, becomes an architect. And then the wife stays at home with their daughter. And eventually, once the daughter gets older, they decide to hire a nanny. And the wife goes back to work as a writer for a newspaper. And then eventually the nanny becomes the muse for both the husband and the wife. And they just become obsessed with her and her, you know, history or backstory and stuff like that. And it's just very well written. You know, I would read sentences two or three times in this book. And it's astonishing that it's only, like, I think it's just right at 200 pages. Because all of the characters get page time in it, so it easily could have been twice this size. But it's just a very, very good book.
All right. Waiting for Tomorrow by Natacha Apana. And we have to pick up the pace just a little bit, so we don't want to short the nonfiction books. But Tim, what's your next fiction pick?
Well, my next fiction pick is also a collection of short stories, and I'm so pleased that all three of us have short stories on our list, because for your listeners, Charity, I think short stories are one of the best things to have while traveling. You should always have a book when traveling anyway, because you don't have to worry about the battery dying. But, you know, short stories are great because you can look at them and put them down and go on. The Sadness of Beautiful Things by Simon Van Bui, one of my favorite authors. This is his fourth collection of short stories. And these are all a little bit different for him because these are stories that people have told him on his travels, and he has fashioned them or crafted or taken an idea and created a story out of it. So they're kind of all over the place as far as themes and places and characters. But Simon Van Bui is so good at writing so well, so you can read these stories first for the content and second for just his skill at putting these together. And they always sort of deal with strangers being kind to each other or being vulnerable in front of each other or finding some moment of connection in a world where you feel there is none. So as you're sitting in your, you know, airplane waiting for it to take off or something and you feel not connected to anybody else in the cabin, maybe these short stories will help you bridge that a little bit. So.
All right. The Sadness of Beautiful Things by Simon Van Bui. And Jan, I think that brings us to your last fiction pick.
Yeah. It's called French Exit, and it's by Patrick DeWitt, who is famously the author of Sisters Brothers, which the movie has just been in Iowa City. And so, you know, it's pretty much of a send-up. Comedy of manners, maybe tragedy of manners. But anyway, it is... It focuses on this woman named Frances Price. She is very, you know, very hardcore. She's wealthy in New York. She's famous among her friends because when her husband died, she went skiing and came back after the weekend to deal with. Yeah. but she has this cat. Her husband's name was Frank, and she has this cat called Small Frank that she honestly believes embodies the soul of her husband. She has a ne'er-do-well son named Malcolm, who's, you know, mid-30s, never supported himself, and suddenly they're out of money. And so they go to France, to Paris, where she has a friend, and their lives are more concerned with how they're actually going to survive than they ever have been. But in that way, it feels very much like sort of a send-up of a Henry James novel or something. Mm-hmm. And in Paris, they get involved in they're comfortable in this kind of high society thing. And so they can fool people about their financial situation because of their class.
Sure.
And that's sort of the subject of it. You know, it's very funny, and it feels British, even though it's American. I don't know why. And it's just sort of a very enjoyable read, a very, very well written.
And you feel worth reading just for the cat.
The cat, actually, I had the hardest time with.
Oh, really? No.
But the cat is always there, and even though this woman appears to be without emotion, she has this strange, and not the way that people talk to animals in baby voices or anything, but she actually believes this cat is her husband.
Interesting. All right. French Exit by Patrick DeWitt and Hunter. Why don't you give us both of your remaining fiction picks, just briefly?
Okay, yeah. So I had the My Year of Rest and Relaxation by Otessa Moshfegh. And basically the main character in this novel, which I think she remains unnamed throughout it, but her goal is to stay asleep as long as possible. And so then she finds a quack psychiatrist that will just prescribe her these heavy-duty sleeping pills and anti-anxiety medication and different things like that. And so then she takes all these pills to try and sleep as long as possible. But then she finds out that she's at some points will wake up and find, you know, empty boxes of takeout around her and or that she went shopping and things like that. So she knows that she's awake during parts of these or at least out moving around. But yeah, I really enjoyed that. And then the last one I had was...
All right, I'll repeat the name. My Year of Rest and Relaxation. That sounds kind of extreme. Rest and Relaxation.
Oh, yeah.
By Otessa Moshfegh. All right. And the last one.
Was Lucky Man by Jamel Brinkley, who went to the workshop, I believe, and then, which is a collection of short stories. He deals a lot with topics of like race and masculinity and male friendships. But yeah, these are just totally, you just get lost in each one of these stories. And yeah, I loved all of them.
Yeah, that's right. It's a great book.
All right, double endorsement, even though it wasn't on your list. All right, Lucky Man by Jamel Brinkley. And collection of short stories. Tim, how about your last fiction pick?
My last fiction pick is a horror novel, just because I know everybody has a horror reader on their list, and they're always like, what should I buy them? And it doesn't always have to be the latest Stephen King. This is a book called The Hunger by Alma Katsu, and it is the story of the Donner Party, which is terrifying enough, I think. But in this case, she has added the element of some sort of supernatural predator that is stalking the wagon train as they move west. It's very similar to, I think, The Terror by Dan Simmons, which is set in the Antarctic, I believe, or the Arctic. And they just made that into a cable miniseries.
It also reminds me of The Deadlands by Benjamin Percy, the Lewis and Clark.
But she said in her acknowledgments, it was a little tough to write because there's so much already written about the Donner Party. She didn't have a lot of wiggle room. And you're never quite sure what this creature is. It feels like a werewolf, but I think she's leaning more towards the Native American legends about shapeshifters. Mm. But there is something, even as the wagon train is starving to death, there is something else that is feeding on them. It did give me nightmares, and I am not responsible if anyone else experiences the same. It is a very horrifying book. And mainly, I think, because she never fully describes these creatures, so you're left to your own imagination, which, of course, is the scariest thing of all, usually.
Right. So is this one of your guilty pleasures, or did you read it for research purposes?
Because they're snowbound, and it's just such a perfect winter book. And, you know, you have the option of locking your doors, which the people in this book do not. So I just think it's a very, very creepy, wonderful book. So,
all right. The Hunger by Alma Katsu. And here we are, almost to our break, and it's time to move into nonfiction. So do you want to, Jan, you want to give us just a tease, and then we'll dive into your first pick? Just tell me the name.
You mean the name of
your first nonfiction
pick. Oh, my first nonfiction pick is going to be The Only Girl by Robin Green.
All right. And we'll dig into that in just a moment. We will take a short break. It's our holiday book show. We're talking about the best new fiction and nonfiction books for grown-ups. We talked about kids' books last week, and you can find our list of the best new books for children on our website, iowapublicradio.org. We'll also be putting this list up on our website later today, iowapublicradio.org. With me, Jan Weissmiller and Tim Budd of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City, and Hunter Gillum of Beaverdale Books in Des Moines. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's our annual holiday book show. We're finding out about the best new books for giving and receiving this holiday season. And we're going to dive into nonfiction now with our guests Jan Weissmiller and Tim Budd of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City and Hunter Gillum of Beaverdale Books in Des Moines. And I don't want to shortchange the nonfiction, but we do need to be a little brief in our descriptions. And just before the break, I made you give us a tease, Jan, The Only Girl by Robin Green. Tell us about it.
Well, Robin Green. It's called The Only Girl because she was the first woman to be on the masthead of the magazine Rolling Stone. And she, you know, went to Brown University, probably late 60s, and in the early 70s, went to California and got involved with Rolling Stone. And there are a lot of really wonderful, like, Big Sur stories about that. And then she was fired because she was assigned to write about the children of Robert Kennedy, and she slept with one of them and didn't want to turn the story in. And Jan Renner said, you know, if you don't turn it in, I'm going to have to fire you. And she said, yeah, I know. But she didn't turn it in. And so then she applied to the workshop, got on a waiting list, and sort of and then asked John Hawks from Brown to sort of write her a stronger recommendation and got in, and actually met her husband here, who was from Iowa City, and still together, and they wrote for the Sopranos, so they were the executive producer and the writers for the Sopranos. So you get this whole like life of a pretty strong woman, and very detailed, as you could imagine, somebody that's done that kind of writing, whose memoir would be, and it really gives you a taste of the time, and it's a great book.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
All right, The Only Girl by Robin Green. And Hunter, what's your first nonfiction pick?
My first one was The Recovering by Leslie Jamison, and she sort of tells her story of her recovery from alcohol addiction, and then also tells the history of recovering and sort of AA. And then is also able to just goes into the sort of idea of the, the alcoholic artist and stuff like that. And she looks a lot at like John Berryman and Raymond Carver and Dennis Johnson. And most of them, you know, they were addicts or whatever. And were worried that if they stopped, that they wouldn't be able to keep producing their work. And then I think it was Dennis Johnson that eventually he realized that, you know, in the last 5 years, he'd put out one book of short stories and a poetry book. And so he figured that, you know, even if he got sober, it couldn't hurt too much. But I just loved it. And she also went to the workshop. And so then you're reading these places where a lot of it takes place in Iowa City. And so a lot of the places she's talking to about, I have been to and stuff like that. And so I really enjoyed that.
All right. The Recovering, Intoxication, and Its Aftermath by Leslie Jamison. And that brings us around to you, Tim.
Well, my top book for nonfiction this year is a book called Innumerable Insects by Michael S. Engel. And this is published by the American Museum of Natural History. And it's a total visual book. It's so difficult to talk about on the radio. But All the illustrations in this book are from their rare book collection. So it is sort of the John James Audubon of bug prints. They are so beautiful. Some of them are in their natural habitat. Some of them are laid out kind of like Victorian collections. You get a lot of text and science about evolution and bugs and that sort of thing. But this is a family book. And it sort of put me in mind of pulling out the encyclopedia and looking at the color plates inside, you know, on those rainy days. But I think kids will be fascinated by the pictures of bugs, and because they're illustrations, they're not as scary as real photos. But there's as much info in there as you want to glean from the text, but there is just a smorgasbord of feasting for the eyes when you just look at these beautiful, beautiful illustrations.
All right. That sounds great. Innumerable Insects, The Story of the Most Diverse and Myriad Animals on Earth by Michael S. Engel. And Jan, back to you.
Well, I'm going to stick with my woman thing for a minute.
All right.
And talk about this. This book called Ninth Street Women by Mary Gabriel, and it's about the women abstract expressionists, Lee Krasner, Elaine de Kooning, Grace Hardigan, Joan Mitchell, and Helen Frankenthaler. And she is an amazing biographer. She also wrote Love and Capital about Jenny and Karl Marx, and she's really good at the backstory. It's not just the biography of these people, but it's the time. And so you have this like amazing feel of New York between the late 30s and the late 50s and the sort of incredible moment that was for both painting and poetry. And she's really interested in how they influence each other. She talks about the dark stuff too. The drinking and the adultery and all that kind of thing, but it's really not about that. And the women, these women are portrayed so strongly, and it's about just how much guts they had and how much agency, to go to New York and to do this. None of them coming
from such a male-dominated field.
Yeah, and none of them coming from the kind of background that. Any kind of class background that would have supported them. And it's an incredible read. And it reads quickly. I mean, it's big, but you sort of don't want to put it down.
Right.
So you just keep reading it.
It sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
All right. Ninth Street Women, Five Women Painters and the Movement That Changed Modern Art by Mary Gabriel. And we're back to you, Hunter.
I had the library book by Susan Orlean. And so it starts off, talks about the library fire that happened in L.A. in 1968 or 1986. And it is like the largest library fire that has happened in the United States. And so it kind of starts off like it's going to be a true crime where she's sort of trying to figure out who did it. But then morphs quickly into just being a history of the L.A. library. And she talks about all of the different eccentric library directors that they had. They're fighting to get to the building that the library – that the fire occurred in. And it's just, sort of also just a love letter to libraries in general. It's just a very, very good book.
All right. The Library Book by Susan Orlean. And, of course, she has captivated people with true stories for quite some time now. Back to you, Tim.
My next title is called The Escape Artists by Neil Bascom. And this deals with it's very topical because we've just celebrated the 100th anniversary of, the end of World War I. So this is a group of British pilots who are in a German POW camp, and their one goal is to get out. In this particular POW camp, they've taken all of the men who have been problems because they've tried to escape so often and put them all together in a higher security camp. Well, of course, you put all these guys together that know how to escape, and they're just going to keep trying to do it.
This is nonfiction. You're not describing the plot of The Great Escape.
No. But when I read this book, it reminded me a lot of The Great Escape. But because this escape in 1918 became so famous that one of the men who was a participant of the escape 20 years later for World War II is giving workshops to the British soldiers on how to escape in World War II if you're caught. It is just a dynamite. There's so many letters and diaries that the author got a hold of. You really feel like you're right there. The class system is still very much in place, so the officers are treated much better than their underlings. Officers who attempted to escape would get solitary confinement. Enlisted men would be shot. So mostly the officers were the only people who could get away with trying to escape. But you are very much in this camp and in that tunnel, and I've never felt so claustrophobic as when I read this book. But it is a thrilling adventure, and I think appeals to anybody who's interested in history or especially military history. It's really a wonderful read.
All right. The Escape Artists, A Band of Daredevil Pilots and the Greatest Prison Break of the Great War by Neil Bascom. My list is getting so long. Jan, what's next on your list?
Well, I'm going to talk about the new biography of Frederick Douglass, which is by David W. Blight, who's an historian at Yale. And it's the first biography that has been written on Frederick Douglass in 30 years. It's actually the first one I've ever read. I mean, but it's informed by the fact that a scrapbook was found that one of his sons put together. So there is a whole lot of new information. But it's also sort of timely because it talks a lot about his relation to other kinds of freedom movements besides just abolitionism. I mean, he was at the Seneca Falls thing in 1848, where the first time that they brought up having women vote, and he really believed that women should vote. And then later he was afraid that if they kept fighting for women's right to vote, it would undercut, you know, blacks' right to vote. And but he also believed that the country should we should have lots of immigrants, and you know, he believed in the freedom of Native Americans. The Chinese were being really
discriminated against,
and he believed that shouldn't happen. And he had this sort of really big, large vision. And so it's very interesting to read about that, and also obviously about his life, about his marriages and his escape. And he stayed in touch with his slave owner throughout his life. He wrote brutal, angry letters, and then eventually forgave him. It's
fascinating.
Yeah.
With new primary source material,
right.
That sounds fantastic. Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom by David W. Blight. Back to you, Hunter.
So I had Educated by Tara Westover, which I know has been all over the place, but I still had to pick it because it's just incredible.
Sometimes books are all over the place for a reason.
Yeah. and she was, so she's raised in Idaho in a Mormon household and is just super isolated from the outside world. She doesn't go to school, and her homeschooling largely consists of her just helping her dad in the junkyard. She doesn't even know, so she has to teach herself trigonometry in order to score high enough on her ACT so that she can get into BYU. And she gets to BYU and realizes, that she doesn't know what the Holocaust was, or doesn't know anything about the civil rights movement. And so she's sort of just the whole time is, coming from behind and has to learn all these things on her own. And then she would eventually go on to Harvard and Cambridge. But it is just, fascinating book.
I know it's on a lot of people's favorite book from 2018 list, too. Again, with reason. Educated by Tara Westover. Tim, your turn. By the way, we have about 5 minutes.
Okay, I'll be quick.
Total.
Next book is Conan Doyle for the Defense by Margaret Fox. Margaret Fox is a writer for the New York Times. This is a story of a murder in Scotland in 1908 that became sort of the crime of the moment. Someone who perhaps the man, Oscar Slater, who was convicted, was perhaps the evidence was pretty shaky against him. And it's not until Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, gets involved some 20 years after the case that eventually gets this man freed. She does a great job about just the period of the time and just bringing in all these different threads that would have led the police to really kind of frame this German Jewish immigrant. It struck me as sounding so much like the times we live in now. But it's a wonderful book for anybody who's into true crime or mystery, and you don't have
or
to be
Sherlock
a
Holmes.
Well, or you, if you're a fan, great. If you're not, you don't have to be. But it's a wonderful it's a wonderful book about law.
All right, Conan Doyle for the Defense: The True Story of a Sensational British Murder, A Quest for Justice, and the World's Most Famous Detective. Writer by Margaret Fox, and that the title's longer than your description. All right, Jan, what's next?
Well, I'm going to talk about Storm Lake and kind of like Hunter saying, you know, everybody's been talking about Educated. Everybody in Iowa's been talking about Storm Lake. But
again,
I still am
going
to talk
yep.
about it. And it's Art Cullen's book, which he wrote after he won the Pulitzer Prize in Journalism in 2017 for reporting on water pollution in Des Moines in a lawsuit. And Storm Lake, obviously, is Steve King's district. And he is just up there fighting the good fight. He's amazing. And to have the guts to have a liberal newspaper in that town and in that district and to have these amazing editorials week after week after week. I mean, he said, you know, when Viking called and offered him a book deal, he said, I can't write a book. I write these. I'm running a newspaper. And then he hung up and his wife is saying, you know, are you out of your mind? So he said, okay, but if I do it, I'm going to do it in 6 weeks or no, 6 months. Yeah. But he got this manuscript in quickly. But it's just remarkable what his sort of deep understanding of farming and immigration and how they work together and over decades. I mean, and he has so much common sense. He's sort of like Mark Twain. I mean, he's wry. He is really quite funny. He's not on a high horse. He just honestly believes this is common sense, and if you just keep repeating it, people are going to listen.
All right, Storm Lake, A Chronicle of Change, Resilience, and Hope from a Small Town Newspaper by Art Cullen. And Ben Kiefer, host of River to River, hung out in Storm Lake with Art Cullen, and you can find that interview on our website at iowapublicradio.org if you're interested in that. And back to you, Hunter.